SBS Audio is supported by advertising.
SBS is Australia's most trusted multilingual broadcaster. Our listeners are loyal, highly engaged, and have supported countless local businesses. We offer advertising packages for businesses of all sizes. Our experienced sales team will guide you through the process of owning a great campaign. Bring your own ad or have our production team make you something in one of our 68 languages. Start the conversation with your new audience today. Email sales at sbs.com.au.
SBS, a world of difference. You're with NITV Radio, on mobile, online and on radio.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land NITV Radio broadcasts from, the Cammeraygal people and their elders past and present. We also acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes and clans we broadcast to, from the mountains to the plains, from the desert to the sea, from fresh water to salt water.
Yaman, welcome to NITV Radio. I'm Bertrand Tungandame. Coming up in your program this Wednesday, the 13th of March, Sarah Corrigan will share her story about completing five TAFE courses and working on our country, thanks to a program that encourages mob to get skills in priority employment. Also on NITV Radio today, Birpa Idangati woman Auntie Rhoda Radley discusses her feelings about the Black Man's Point massacre near Port Macquarie. Your program will also explore how the Commonwealth Paid Parental Leave Scheme will soon include superannuation guarantee contributions from next year. All these stories and more coming to you on NITV Radio after the latest news.
Australia Day 1972 saw the first Aboriginal embassy erected outside Parliament.
The native title legislation must be amended.
And they've walked this land so many times before anybody came.
I am sorry.
This bulletin, a $1 billion package unveiled to fully fund all schools in the Northern Territory, including those in remote First Nations communities. The government forced to reissue visas to immigration detainees after a legal bungle. And negotiators in the Middle East are hopeful a ceasefire deal can be reached on Gaza during the month of Ramadan. The federal government has unveiled a landmark funding agreement with the Northern Territory that it says will see its schools fully funded within 5 years. The funding is designed to bring each territory student up to the schooling resource standard, which is the minimum funding required to meet educational needs. Education Minister Jason Clare says one in five children in the territory are currently not receiving any funding. He says the funding needed for a public school student in the top end is almost double the national average because of the territory's remote locations and large Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander population.
We know that here in the Northern Territory, there are some of the most disadvantaged communities in the country and some of the most underfunded public schools in the country. Under the Gonski model, public schools here in the Northern Territory at the moment are funded at less than 80% of that original Gonski model. What we're announcing today is about fixing that.
A permanent memorial will be built in Darwin to honour the victims of Cyclone Tracy 5 years ago. The Australian government will give $600,000 to the Northern Territory government for a kinetic monument at Bondilla Beach, as well as a memorial designed by a local artist at East Point. 71 people died, more than 600 were injured, and 80% of the city was destroyed in the cyclone that hit the city in the early hours of Christmas morning in December 1974. More than 36,000 people left Darwin in its wake, while for those who stayed, the damage bill topped $800 million. Four children are part of a group of seven people missing in a remote part of southern Western Australia, experiencing flash flooding and heavy rainfall. Western Australia Police Inspector Mick Kelly says the search for the group has been hampered to date by the conditions, including a plane that was only able to stay in the sky for about an hour on Tuesday. Inspector Kelly says there are serious concerns for their welfare because 120 millimetres of rain had been forecast to hit the area in the last 24 hours. He says the group is believed to be split between two vehicles that have minimal food on board, though one has water, bedding and camping gear. The federal government says it's addressed a technical issue in the visas of a group of asylum seekers in Australia. Home Affairs Minister Claire O'Neill says the flow had the immediate effect of making visas issued under that visa class since 2013 instantly invalid, but those visas have now been reissued. She says the problem applied to the 149 people released from indefinite detention after last year's High Court decision were subject to strict monitoring conditions. The minister has told Channel 7 there's no need for concern.
The important thing for your viewers is that community safety has been our absolute priority in everything that we have dealt with on this issue. So those tough visa conditions have been reapplied to people, whether it's ankle monitoring bracelets, whether it's curfews and the like, and we'll continue to focus on that as we move forward on this issue.
Qatar says it remains hopeful that a ceasefire deal can be reached on Gaza during the month of Ramadan. Talks are at a standstill, despite hopes of US, Qatar and Egypt mediators to broker an agreement that would address prisoner release and aid delivery ahead of the normally joyous holiday. Hamas is demanding guarantees that any such agreement will lead to an end to the war, while Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has rejected that demand, vowing to continue the offensive until total victory against the militant group and the release of all the remaining hostages held in Gaza. Foreign Ministry spokesperson Majed Al-Ansari says that Qatar is still working within the framework of a truce that has the appropriate conditions.
We were all hoping that the people of Gaza can receive the holy month of Ramadan with some notion of peace, some notion of normalcy, and sadly that did not happen. When it comes to the expectations, I can't offer any timeline, sadly, at the moment. The situation is very complicated on the ground.
Displaced Palestinians have reacted with disdain to the pending arrival of an aid ship being sent to Gaza from Cyprus, loaded with 200 tons of food gathered by a charity group. Sula Fawadala, who is currently living in a tent in Rafah after being forced out of the Al-Shadi camp, says many are skeptical of the shipment because all they want is to be able to go home. Meanwhile, in Khan Yunis, cement blocks have been seen as part of a project to build a temporary pier on Gaza's Mediterranean coast. World Central Kitchen has said it is building a landing jetty with material from destroyed buildings and rubble, an initiative separate to a plan announced by U.S. President Joe Biden last week to build a temporary pier. WCK founder Jose Andreas has previously told MSNBC his organization has 63 kitchens inside Gaza providing food, but they need more resources.
We're doing almost around 350,000 hot meals a day. Obviously, in the places we are, especially in Rafah, those kitchens are able to be use the daily needs of the families in the different camps surrounding our kitchens. We are able to have kitchens all the way to the middle part of Gaza, just south of Gaza City. And we are very proud of that work. But again, much more is needed.
Two people have reportedly been shot in a bus hijacking in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil's second most populous city. Local police say the pair were attacked outside the vehicle and then the man hijacked the bus, which had been waiting at the Rio transit station for its trip to city of Juiz de Fora in Minas Gerais state. Police Colonel Marco Andrade says the man eventually handed himself in after holding 17 people on the bus hostage for around 3 hours. The colonel says they appear to be unharmed.
The kidnapper handed himself over to the military police. He is under arrest. All the hostages were released. Safe. They are now undergoing preliminary assistance from firefighters to check their psychological conditions and other things.
And back home, Australia has doubled down in its support for the United States and the planned acquisition of nuclear submarines amid concerns there are problems with production. America is set to sell Australia at least 3 and possibly 5 second-hand Virginia-class subs in the early 2030s, but one submarine has been cut from the 2025 proposed U.S. defense budget, and others are running an average of 30 months late in assembly. Rank-and-file Labor members have come out against the AUKUS agreement, but Defence Minister Richard Marles says Australia, Britain and America remain committed to the pact and confident the subs will be delivered. Opposition leader Peter Dutton says he agrees with that assessment.
There will be difficulties from time to time, either at the US end or the Australian end or the UK end, but they will be ironed out because in the end, our three countries coming together make us stronger than if we stand apart.
And new figures show 1 in 10 patients are waiting almost 11 hours for treatment in New South Wales emergency rooms. The data from the Bureau of Health Information shows that while almost 60% of patients spent under 4 hours in the emergency department, 1 in 10 spent almost 10 and a half hours, well above pre-pandemic waiting times. Australian Medical Association State President Michael Bonning says the figures should serve as a wake-up call for the state government. And to sport, the husband of former Olympic rider Melissa Hoskins will face court today over her health, her death. Former world champion road cyclist Rohan Dennis was arrested in January and charged with causing death by dangerous driving, driving without due care and endangering life. Police allege Dennis recklessly struck the 32-year-old mother of two with his car in front of their home in Mendidi in Adelaide's inner north on December 30th. And now having a look at the weather around the country. Broome, rainy day, 30 degrees. Perth, partly cloudy, 30. Adelaide, cloudy, 33. Melbourne, a shower or 2, 20. Hobart, partly cloudy, 21. Albury-Wodonga, cloudy, 30. Canberra, partly cloudy, 29. Wollongong, similar conditions, 26. Sydney, partly cloudy, 28. Newcastle, same forecast, 30 degrees. Brisbane, partly cloudy, 29. Townsville, sunny, 31. Cairns, possible shower, 32. Alice Springs, sunny, 37. Darwin, showers, 30. And the Torres Strait Islands, scattered thunderstorms and a top of 28 degrees. And that is NITV Radio News.
TV Radio, Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 1 p.m. or anytime online.
I'm Bertrand Tungandame and you're listening to NITV Radio coming to you from Nam on the Kulin Nation this Wednesday afternoon. Coming up next, Birpai Dangati woman, Auntie Rhonda Radley, discusses her feelings about the Black Man's Point massacre near Port Macquarie. We also explore how Commonwealth Paid Parental Leave Scheme will soon include superannuation guarantee contributions from next year. But first, meet this deadly woman who has completed 5 TAFE courses and is now enjoying working on Aboriginal country thanks to a fee-free TAFE program that encourages mob to get skills in priority employment.
You're with NITV Radio.
My guest Sarah Corrigan lives and works on Aboriginal country and has completed a total of 5 TAFE courses in Newcastle. Sarah, thanks for joining us on NITV Radio today.
Thank you for having me.
As I said, you work on Aboriginal country. Is it your country, first of all, or you just happen to be working and living there?
I've been working and living on Aboriginal country now for almost 18 years, and I am originally from Darkanyung country, which is just sort of over the mountains, bit further down on the central coast, yeah.
Yeah, still in New South Wales. And you've completed 5 TAFE courses. I've got here Certificate 4 in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Primary Healthcare, where you gained actually your Australian Health Practitioners Registration Authority, and many more. Just run us through how you went through all these courses and, tell us your journey, your story.
I've always worked, in health, sort of, I suppose, on the edges when I was studying at uni doing other things, and then had my children, so working full-time wasn't an immediate option, but I knew that I wanted to get back into doing something I enjoyed and making a difference for MOB. So I actually started off with doing a cert for in allied health, did some practical subjects with that, realised it was something I really enjoyed. So that then prompted me, when a role came up for an Aboriginal health worker in New South Wales Health, I applied for that. And when I was in that role, realising that there were gaps and knowledges and things that I could still gain to, you know, do even better with my job. So I went and did my certificate for in alcohol and other drugs and mental health. We also, as part of our role, I then went and did my cert for in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander primary healthcare practice. And that was what actually allowed us to then move from sort of, I suppose, being a health worker doing sort of that social support into that more clinical skill set. While I was doing all of that, I realised that wanted to sort of move even further, I suppose, and be able to do things more my way and MOB's way. And so there's a real gap in the mental health care system for a lot of our MOB. So I started my own business, and part of that, like, it's great to get our MOB healthy and engaging and, you know, part of the system, but it's also about the systems being culturally competent and safe when they get there. So I do training and consultancy, and decided that I wanted to do my
Cert for in training and assessing,
which then allowed me to really create programs that have got learning outcomes in cultural competency and training for non-Aboriginal people. So it sort of all, I suppose, started with one, and then that showed me a pathway that I could build on to eventually get a range of skills and qualifications that I can use practically in my own business.
Through a specific government program.
Steal by Kev Comedy.
Was it easy? Also juggling work-life balance and studying?
Yeah, well, I think that's one of the really deadly things about TAFE, is the way it's set up. It's set up for people who either maybe are a mature age student like myself, so I wasn't straight out of school going into TAFE. They really understand that you know, you often do have commitments outside of TAFE. So with, I did it through fee-free courses. So what that meant was you don't end up sort of with a huge hex debt at the end of it, which can be another stress when you're trying to juggle work and kids. But also you sort of do a mix of, some of the stuff is done in classrooms, some of it's done online. Then you have like block releases where you're really well supported, often by other MOB. And I think because you've got all those flexible options, you can make it work and fit into your life, I suppose, rather than trying to fit another extra into an already busy schedule.
And five courses, that's quite a lot. Of course, you've explained a little bit, because it's part of your requirements. You took on courses as you're going, and you realized there were gaps in your skills, and you wanted to just, you know, close those gaps and so on. Yeah. But doing five courses, not everyone has got the patience and the capacity to do that.
Yeah, I think that's a little bit of my inner nerd sometimes coming out. I do like to study, and I always think there's more that you can learn. But when I say I've done five courses, it wasn't like I did five courses back to back. You know, it was sort of, I started with my allied health assistant. That got my foot in the door to be working as an Aboriginal health worker. From that, realising there was a courses that I could do to support that existing role. So that was like the AAD, so alcohol and other drugs, and mental health, cert four that I did. Then sort of from that, realised that there was the Aboriginal health practitioner role that we could do through TAFE. So I did that probably about another 18 months later. And then when I had actually sort of moved from working for New South Wales Health and then running my own business, was when I then decided to go back and do my cert four in training and assessing. That was the awesome thing about it too, is that it sounds like a lot, like five courses, but they all build on each other. So there's core units. So often if you're sort of following that health pathway of courses at TAFE like I have, you mightn't have to do the full 2 years each time. You say get your recognition of prior learning. So that can reduce some of the theory time that you've got to do.
Yeah, so you're doing courses in the same area, and you really managed to fill in all the courses because of the fact that you're just building on prior skills and learning maybe modules that you may not have learned from the previous courses, and you're just adding on more knowledge, actually, building more knowledge. Wow, that's great.
And I think with TAFE too, one of the other things is a lot of the assessments are practical. So it's not like you do have written assessments, but you also, if you're already working in the industry, you know, your work can count towards your work placement. You can be assessed on the job, and that also helps because it's not like you've then got to find another, you know, placement or another place to be assessed, and that definitely makes it easier when you've, you know, got commitments outside of home, like outside of TAFE, if you've got commitments at home and with mobbing community. Yeah, so it definitely... I think that's a really cool part of it, is that your assessments and the knowledge you learn, yes, some of it's theory, but then a lot of it you actually do on the job as well.
And how does it feel working in our local country with MOB?
I feel blessed and privileged every single day that I get to work with the community. I'm also really, really empowered that I'm not just sort of talking the talk, but I'm also walking the walk as well. The fact that we're still successful, you know, about 4 years running now, I think shows that this was needed for community, but I think it's also lovely because it shows me that community trust me to hold this space, and that there is that really true engagement with being well and healthy, not just for ourselves now, but for all the generations to come.
Would you recommend to other people to follow in your footsteps, because you've been so successful in this journey?
Absolutely. I think that TAFE offers, for anyone, but in particular offers more a real pathway to having self-determination around our own careers. Why it is so valuable for MOB too is that there's such good support from your Aboriginal student support officers, your Aboriginal units at TAFE. They often have courses that are designed where they understand all of those competing priorities. So anything you go to them with that you might see as being a bit of a barrier to getting through TAFE, they'll come up with a solution. And I think that's the amazing thing. They want to see you succeed. And that's really, really empowering when you're studying. I'm actually looking at putting a few of my First Nations employees actually through some courses at TAFE as well. So to me, that's how valuable it is. I want to instill the same kind of learnings and knowledge in the staff that I employ.
Sarah Corrigan, thank you very much for taking the time to share your story with us, and congratulations on such a fantastic journey.
Thank you.
Visit sbs.com.au/NITV Radio.
Just a reminder, Sarah Corrigan's story is published on our website, sbs.com.au/NITV Radio. We must now step aside for a break, but stay with us, because when we come back, Auntie Rhonda will reflect on the Black Man's Point massacre near Port Macquarie. It is believed a large number of local Aboriginal people were forcibly moved to Black Man's Point just to be massacred shortly after. Coming up next, a conversation on country podcast series story. It's a story from the Conversations on Country podcast series. It's the story of the Black Man's Point Massacre, a reflection by Auntie Rhonda.
NITV Radio, on radio, online and mobile.
Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are warned that the following recordings may contain the sounds and voices of deceased persons. Conversations on Country is a series of diverse stories of place and being of the Goombangia, Jangati, Biripai and Waramai nations.
Barabai Tiereban Rhonda Radley. My name's Auntie Rhonda. A strong Biripai Dangari woman, and we're sitting here at Blackman's Point. So Blackman's Point is north and south of Hastings River. Beautiful afternoon here. And we have Wakan the crow in the background. So he's one of our spirit birds. So we won't mind him if he gets a bit talkative and loud, eh? I think for me, it's my responsibility to heal my trauma, and part of my trauma is what my ancestors experienced. So for me, I feel I have a strong obligation not to hand that on to the next generation. And that trauma I felt stemmed from loss of land, separated from family, and unfinished business, like here at Blackman's Point, where we're wanting some recognition, acknowledgement of what happened here as part of the collective Australian history. And I think, you know, I always feel that we're here for a reason, and I think Blackman's Point massacre is, you know, part of that story for me, just to push that forward. As a child, I would go on the boats with Uncle, and one night I remember I would go with him, come out, he was doing a shot, putting a net out, and I was only a little one, and we were coming right over here, very close to the sandbar, and I just remember having this real strong sense of sadness and real shiver in my bones as a little one. And yeah, I think through, you know, that child's lens. I remember coming out onto the veranda, because that's where we go to the toilet when we're little ones, and I would see this spirit at the end of this log that was overhanging the creek, and he would be just sitting there waiting. And yeah, I'd often see him there, and I just sort of had a sense, because I knew the story then, that maybe he's waiting for something, for his spirit to be at rest, or his family spirit to be at rest. It just seemed like, you know, something need to be done. As a child, I just thought I had this real sense. Can't say I knew when I first heard it, because we're always eardropping as children. So we maybe heard it but didn't hear it. And then later on we have more of a conversation around it. So you hear things, but, you know, you, in some ways you're eardropping, and it was adult talk. Yeah, but yeah, I can't say when, but I know that time that I just recounted is when I felt it. I felt the story. Well, the story was that that's quite a few. What's come through our story, there was quite a few. There was, you know, a suggestion about 300 Aboriginal people were herded down here, and were herded in onto the sandbar, and they were just mowed down, they were shot. And what happened was that the women were raped before they were shot. There's no mention in the records about the children, but we know through our oral story that the women didn't go anywhere without the children, but there was no mention of the children. And that's what, you know, what the resistance was. Well, there's no written evidence, but there is evidence in Wilson's diary, so of saying about the killing of the men and the raping of the women. But there's the children that's in our story. Where's the children? We know the children were also part of that killing. You know, you've got to set the scene in those days where, you know, we weren't even considered human. You know, when we talk to people about that, they just can't get their head around it. How could that be? But that's just part of our history, and you've got to go back and look at those times. And, you know, we had some stories where, you know, that come through, but a lot of the time, you know, it was sort of bad business. Like, we as Aboriginal people, you know, we're just moving across the land, you know, practicing our culture, and in lots of ways, it was quite different to how white fellows would move across the land, because it was all about ownership, owning something. As I think our mob, I know our mob, it was more having a relationship with it. So, you know, that might be just a tree. To a white fellow, cut it down because I want to live there, sort of thing. But you might have been taken someone's kin out. We had a relationship maybe with that area. So for me, you know, when I'm Birrapai Dungari, born in Port Macquarie, so I have a real spirit connection here to Port Macquarie and surrounding areas, all the, I suppose, the land I've walked over, I've felt a sense of belonging to, and I'm forever, will be forever grateful for that, because that's what gives me strength, that real connection to Nyabarai, Mother Earth. Yeah, I think there's a lot of things in play when we start talking, you know, about why people resist or how people feel. We talk about generational trauma, we talk about generational guilt, and we, you know, talk about the resistance because this area, if it's then recognised as a massacre site, will it reduce, you know, property? That's where, you know, some people were coming from, but, you know, my property's not going to be worth as much because it's near a massacre site. I don't know if that's true or not. But we shouldn't, you know, people would come here and feel it anyway. We have a story of this lady that contacted the Birrapai Land Council some time ago, and she had a little Aboriginal foster child, and she came here, and she said that this little boy, he just laid down and he said, was very traumatised, and he said, stop the noises, stop the screaming. And she rang the land council and said, did anything bad happen here? So even though we may resist wanting to know, I think there is a deep knowing that this is true, that something bad happened here.
Conversations on Country is proudly brought to you by SBS and Saltwater Freshwater Arts Alliance and was recorded on Gumbangir, Dangati, Birrapai and Warramai land. Our storyteller for this episode was proud Birrapai woman Rhonda Radley. Theme music was recorded by Grow the Music with Carrie Munro Greentree on guitar and Ben Ferguson on didgeridoo. Special thanks also to Maddie Whitford. Production of this podcast series was by Simon Portis and Liz Keane from Headline Productions, with additional production by Maddie Whitford. A big thank you also to the Murrumbi Aboriginal Language and Culture Cooperative for their guidance. I'm Michael Jarrett. Darundang.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
Now, Australian parents are set to receive superannuation payments whilst taking paid parental leave. The payment will be added to government-funded parental leave with hopes it will bridge the gap between men's and women's super. Katriana Stirrat reports.
When Sam Carl took maternity leave, she thought that would include superannuation payments. She soon realised that wasn't the case. Her husband already $60,000 ahead of her in retirement funds. Instead of sitting back, Sam decided to do something, pushing the government to add superannuation to paid parental leave. Ms. Carl says after 4 years of campaigning the government, That work has paid off.
Since she was 4 months old, I came here, I was breastfeeding still. And so she's about to turn five. So to have this come through is absolutely amazing. So it feels like it's one step closer. It's not going to help me currently or in the future, but it will help many generations of women in the future.
The federal government has announced superannuation will be added to the paid parental leave scheme from July 1, 2025. It's part of Labor's Working for Women strategy, Australia's first national strategy to achieve gender equality. Minister for Women, Katie Gallagher, says it's the sensible thing to do.
You're paid super on your sick leave, you're paid super on your annual leave, and there is no reason why it shouldn't be paid on paid parental leave too. The government has taken this decision because it is the right thing to do.
The goal is to reduce the gap between men and women's super. The Parenthood CEO, Georgie Dent, says there's a serious discrepancy between the two at the moment.
On average, women in Australia retire with around 25% less in their superannuation balances than men do. Now, that gap is really a reflection of the fact that women do take more breaks from paid work to take on the caring responsibilities.
Parents will receive an extra 12% payment into their superannuation, $106 each week. It's a move long pushed for by advocates and a recommendation from the government's Women's Economic Equality Task Force. CEO of the Super Members Council, Misha Schubert, says it will mean thousands more for mothers come retirement.
We know that for a mother of two, across the course of her working life, she accesses the scheme twice, is likely to be $14,500 better off at retirement. That will make a powerful difference both to those individual women and to the country.
About 180,000 people access the paid parental leave scheme each year, 99% of them women. The cost of the scheme will be revealed in the May budget. Opposition spokesperson for women, Susan Lee, says the Coalition supports the principle of the announcement.
The Coalition supports the principle of funding superannuation on government-funded paid parental leave. We support the principle. We also will scrutinise all of the detail. That detail wasn't there today. It's important that we get across the detail. It's important that we hear from the Minister, who is also the Finance Minister, about those costings.
The scheme won't fully close the gap between men's and women's super. Ms. Schubert says it's critical to consider what more can be done to support working parents.
It's really important to keep asking ourselves what more can we do to support working parents. Women at the moment pay this sort of financial motherhood penalty when they step out of the paid workforce to do the really important work of raising children in the earliest years of life.
Katrina Stirrett, SBS News.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
And this brings us to the end of today's program. NITV Radio will be back on Friday with more news and stories from right across the country. I'm Bertrand Tungandami. Thank you for your company this Wednesday afternoon. Till next time, bye for now. Yalu.
SBS is Australia's most trusted multilingual broadcaster. Our listeners are loyal, highly engaged, and have supported countless local businesses. We offer advertising packages for businesses of all sizes. Our experienced sales team will guide you through the process of owning a great campaign. Bring your own ad or have our production team make you something in one of our 68 languages. Start the conversation with your new audience today. Email sales@sbs.com.au.